It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, nearly 400 children in Wisconsin are participating in the largest long-term study of brain development and child health in the U.S. We'll talk with the principal investigator at UW-Milwaukee, who happens to be a parent herself, about the results so far. First, we're at the tail end of Mental Health Awareness Month in the United States. And we often hear advice suggesting that people seek mental health therapy for one reason or another. But it can be hard to know where to even start looking. Our next guest is with us to help overcome the common hurdles to finding effective therapy in Wisconsin. You could join in at 800-642-1234. If you yourself have looked for therapy, what kind of obstacles did you encounter? Were you able to find something that you could afford that helped you in your part of the state? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Mary Kay Battaglia is Executive Director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness Wisconsin, or NAMI Wisconsin. Mary Kay, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob, for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, first, how do we know if we might benefit from therapy in the first place?
I would say most people are aware that they're either overly stressed or anxious, or they're not able to function in their daily lives and start perceiving that they might need some help and support. And at that point, I think a lot of people delay getting the help that they need, which is something we discourage. It does take a while to find the right therapist. And sometimes it might require a psychiatrist, but we encourage people to not delay that event, not delay trying to seek the help, because the sooner you get help, the quicker you're on your way to recovery.
And assuming we've made that decision, it might look overwhelming at first. What is the first step? How do we say, okay, I'm going to start my search to connect me with therapy?
Well, sadly, in the United States, the way we find things is first identify what our insurance level is. Do you have Medicaid? Do you have Medicare? Do you have a particular insurance? Do you not have any insurance? And when people call and ask us about that process, that is usually the first place we start, instead of which I would prefer a start is, you know, how can we help? What are your needs? But really, the first step in our country is to figure out what your insurance is, and then to find who your insurance provider allows you to contact. And each insurance company will have a list of providers that they support. And if you don't have insurance, it is a little more difficult, but Medicaid and Medicare do have resources as well that you can find a therapist. It's just sometimes a little harder.
And then aside from coverage, finding the right type of therapist for whatever particular problem we're dealing with, what is the variety of therapies out there? How do we find the one that meets our current needs?
That is a great question. And I think people really need to consider what it is that they're wanting to seek and most comfortable with. I think a lot of people will first identify whether they want a male or a female. They may identify whether they want someone older with experience or someone younger that might be closer to their own age if they're younger. It could be the need to find somebody that works in a specialty area. There are websites that you can go to that allow you to, there's a SAMHSA website that allows you to look up different therapists and the therapeutics that they utilize. There's particular therapies for anxiety, for trauma, for OCD, for depression, and you'll just want to look at who provides those services. There's certifications that therapists go through for those specialty type of therapies, and you'll want to find what it is. And sometimes you may not know what kind of therapy you need, right? And so then you would seek out a person that you identify with, that you feel you would be comfortable with. If you come from a population like the Black community or a Spanish-speaking community might want to be particular in trying to find someone that provides that service. And then they may be able to guide you to who would be the best person to provide that service. It's not always the first person you go to see that can provide you the best service.
And Mary Kay, we talked about financial accessibility. How about geographic accessibility? What do things look like in different parts of Wisconsin when it comes to the availability of therapy and maybe the ability to pick and choose among different potential providers?
That is one thing that the pandemic has helped us with. There's now something called telehealth, and a lot of people are seeing therapists on their computer or their smartphone and can have sessions through a telehealth appointment. And those are reimbursable at this time. A lot of people, like myself, much prefer to see someone in person. And so you're limited by your geographic area. You're right, Rob. Some areas of our state have limited mental health professionals, and it can be more difficult to find a therapist in some of the more rural areas of Wisconsin. But there are support groups, there are ways to connect with online services if that's something people would be open to.
Talking to Mary Kay Battaglia with NAMI Wisconsin, looking at how to seek therapy, how to get professional help for our mental health needs. You can join in with your questions, your experiences at 800-642-1234. Have you been on this search yourself for yourself or a loved one, maybe? Have you used remote therapy, online therapy to meet your needs? If you couldn't find someone in your immediate area, join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a patient or a provider, 800-642-1234 is the number. Mary Kay, I've talked to people over the years who have said, yeah, I went in for therapy, and the first person I saw, they were fine, but it wasn't a good match. It didn't meet my needs, but maybe that second or the third one did. Can you talk about the need to maybe not take to say, oh, this first one didn't work, therefore therapy doesn't work for me?
I think that is a common thing, and I think people need to be prepared. It's a personal relationship. A therapist will be someone that you connect with and can provide the support you need. And we're all very unique. It's a very unique process to get the support you need through a therapist. And you're right, that first one may not be the right fit. You might find that you need somebody that holds you more accountable, or maybe you need someone more empathic to your needs. It's just a unique thing because you're dealing with someone, it's the personality of the therapist, and it's your own, what you bring to the therapy as well. So I encourage people, again, to start the search early because it may not be that first therapist that you connect with that is helpful for you.
We're talking to Mary Kay Battaglia, Executive Director of NAMI Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234 as we talk about how to find a mental health therapy, a therapist, maybe in our own area or online. You can join in with your experiences or your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Were you able to connect with the kind of help you needed? Were there big obstacles, financial and insurance obstacles, or there's nobody in your area who provided the right kind of treatment? Let us know. 800-642-1234 is the number to call or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Mary Kay Battaglia, Executive Director of NAMI Wisconsin. We're talking about common obstacles people face when seeking mental health treatment and how to overcome those obstacles. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you've had trouble seeking mental health treatment, have those problems been mostly financial, logistical, social? Have you ever tried remote or online therapy? What did you think about that? What questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. If you're willing to share your story, 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Mary Kay, can you talk about the kind of resources NAMI provides here in Wisconsin to the people we're talking about, people seeking mental health treatment?
Yes. NAMI Wisconsin is the supporter of 25 affiliates across our state who provide support groups and classes for people living with a mental illness, as well as their family members, especially those family members with people living with a serious mental illness. They sometimes need extra support. So we have classes and support groups that you can connect with at your local affiliate, and you can find your local affiliate at our website. But if you don't have a local affiliate, we, again, through the silver lining of the pandemic, started statewide support groups. And you can find that we started a program called Being Together, because we have several counties that don't have an affiliate located in their midst. And so we created this program called Being Together so that people can join online to a support group. Either a peer support group, which is someone living with a mental illness, or a family support group. And, you know, it does sometimes take a while to find that therapist, and sometimes you have to be put on a wait list, or maybe an appointment's a few months out. And this is a great way for people to connect and feel supported and not feel alone by joining our support groups. And they're absolutely no cost to the person that participates.
Bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Kathy is with us in Delafield. Kathy, hi.
Hi. Hey, I just wanted to mention, as a parent to an adult child who's really, you know, 22, with mental health challenges and also on the spectrum, our experience in Waukesha County was the police, our local police, were awesome, trying to get our daughter off the highway. And unfortunately, the Waukesha County Sheriff had to take her to the hospital for screening, where the social worker spoke to us, spoke to her therapist, and spoke to the police who knew her, all three of us saying she needed to go into residential care. And instead, the social worker released her and followed up with us and said, you know, we have a safety plan in place, and they released her back to the drug house for the safety plan, which is shocking to
Kathy,
me.
Kathy, I'm so sorry to hear about that. Mary Kay, this isn't just in Waukesha County. I know there are concerns when someone appears at an emergency room with some kind of mental health crisis. What happens then with connecting them to services? I know there are a lot of efforts around the state. Do you have thoughts on the experience Kathy brought up?
Kathy, I am sorry. I hear your concern, and it is a very difficult situation, because once someone is an adult, they have to want to seek the help and get the help. And the only way we can get someone to get the help when family members and those around them think they do is to declare them unable to and involuntary admissions. And in our state and most states in the United States, it's very, very hard to get that. They have to be actively a harm to themselves or others. And while I totally understand and respect everyone's privacy and the ability to take care of themselves, the problem is that when people are in a mental health crisis, they frequently aren't thinking very clearly, and we're asking them to think clearly when they're not in a mental state to do so. So you are right. All of those services can be out there, and I highly encourage, as Kathy has pointed out, we have officers throughout the state that are crisis intervention trained. And if you do have to call the emergency number and ask for an officer, ask for a CIT or a mental health officer, because they will be trained on these events and understand that the person is not a criminal, but they are in a mental health crisis, and be a more positive response. But Kathy, I understand your concern. We are currently advocating for crisis stabilization centers and crisis facilities across the state, so that we can find better ways to help people that are in a crisis. But it is a very difficult situation for family members when they know someone needs help and they're not willing to get the help. They don't believe they need the help.
Kathy, thanks for sharing that with us. Best to you and your family and your daughter, of course. Thank you for sharing that. Linda joins us now in Madison. Linda, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. My issue concerns
finding the right kind of psychiatrist or psychologist. I was seeing one because my sister was dying and I was caring for her. And she was great, but then my insurance changed and she didn't take that insurance. Since then, my two sisters, including my best friend and my mother, have died. Hmm. I've been diagnosed with complicated grief or complex grief. I had a psychologist who, bless her soul, her intentions were good, but the worst thing she'd probably ever experienced was flushing her pet goldfish down the toilet. And then I got a psychiatrist who spent all of my appointments writing his next book. Oh. And I have been unable to find someone who specializes in complex grief.
Linda, I thank you for sharing that. I'm sorry for all of your losses. Mary Kay, finding someone who can relate to our problem, in this case, complex grief, and I don't know, is a good fit for us. Do you have thoughts for Linda, Mary Kay?
I'm sorry, Linda, about all your losses. That's a lot to take on. And the diagnosis of complex grief has just entered the DSM-5 and is a newer diagnosis. But having grief and having therapy for that would be similar to long-term depression. And I'm sorry, it's hard to find a compatible therapist for that sort of recovery, which is what you're going through. You're going through a long grief recovery. I would just suggest that you continue to try. You're in Madison and there are some great psychiatrists and psychologists. And I do want to differentiate. A lot of people get those two confused. A psychiatrist is a medical doctor. They go through medical training to become a physician. And then they get a specialty in psychiatry, and they're able to prescribe medications for someone that needs medication. And a psychologist or a master's of social work or a family therapist are not prescribers. And there are more options for therapists and psychologists than there are psychiatry. So some people will need both. And some people will only need a psychologist or a therapist. And I just want to make sure we differentiate those. But I am so sorry to hear of your losses. And I just encourage you to continue to try to find the right match for you, because you deserve that right match.
Linda, good luck to you in that search. Thank you again for calling in. Mary Kay, is there an effort, I guess, on the supply side? Are there efforts to try to get more providers out there available to the public in more parts of the state?
Absolutely. Many of the things that we're advocating for is more seats at both of the medical colleges we have, UW and Medical College of Wisconsin, to increase the number of psychiatric seats that are available, maybe find ways. There's some talk of finding ways to decrease the cost for them to either live in Wisconsin or to go to school in Wisconsin and stay in Wisconsin. There's been some licensing issues and limitations that we've been advocating for. Just in the last year, they opened up the license. So if someone was licensed in adjoining states, that they could practice in our state as well. And there's also a need for other type of assistant therapists, something that we are advocating for, which is a certified peer specialist. So that's somebody who is certified as a person that's lived with a mental illness that can provide that support. I also do want to plug the peer respite centers that we have throughout the state. There are 7 of them, and you can stay at a peer respite center for up to 7 days and have a certified peer specialist there to help you and support you. And they also accept what we call at our office warm line calls. So if you're struggling with your mental health, you can call the peer run respites and they will have somebody, a certified peer specialist, call you back and just talk to you if you need that support. So that is another way through our state that people can receive support when they're feeling either anxious or depressed or down or in grief, as Linda was, that will provide that warm line support to you.
And Mary Kay, that takes me to where I want to end this. Something you brought up at the beginning, this can be a long process finding the health you suggest getting started right away. In addition to that peer support you just mentioned, what are other things people can do to get some help while they're waiting to find or what waiting for that therapist search to bear fruit?
Well, we always encourage you to advocate for yourself. We also advocate that you take positive coping skills, find the things that are positive things that you can do that make you feel better. Find somebody that can advocate with you, because sometimes it's very hard for you to advocate for yourself, a loved one, a family member that can help you. Start the trek of trying to find that therapist. Connect with the respite centers and the warm line, and reach out to NAMI and see if there's a support group or a class that you can take that will help you in that journey. And frequently in those support groups and classes, people will give you information about local resources that will be helpful to you. It is a little bit of a wind of navigation to try to find the perfect fit, but you do have to advocate for yourself. You deserve to feel better, and there is help out there. It just sometimes takes a few extra steps to get there.
Mary Kay, thanks so much for joining us today.
You're very welcome. Thank you so much for acknowledging Mental Health Awareness Month as it comes to an end. Thank you.
That's Mary Kay Battaglia, Executive Director of NAMI Wisconsin. You can find more mental health resources at their website, namiwisconsin.org. That's namiwisconsin.org. Coming up after the news, 12,000 children are participating in the nation's biggest long-term study of child health and brain development. About 400 of them are in Wisconsin. We'll learn more about the study and what researchers have learned since it started in 2015. I'm Rob Verrett. This is Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, the field for Republican candidates for president is growing, but former President Trump is holding on to the lead in the polls so far. We'll look at the latest public opinion on the issues and the options for 2024. Now, our brains are complicated things. It can be difficult to understand what makes them work the way they do. And that's especially important for children and young adults whose brains are still developing. There are a lot of questions about the things that can have an impact on developing brains, from screen time to smoking to alcohol and other drugs. A massive new study is working to answer those questions, and a lot of the work is happening here in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about brain development in children and young adults? If you're a parent, guardian, or grandparent, what observations or experiences do you have? If we're talking about you, if you're a young adult yourself, how do you think about your own brain development? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Krista Lisdahl is a professor of psychology at UW-Milwaukee, where she's director of the Brain Imaging and Neuropsychology Laboratory. She researches the brain development consequences of chronic drug use during adolescence and emerging adulthood, and predictors of substance use onset in youth. And she's a principal investigator for UWM's participation in this nationwide study of adolescent brain cognitive development funded by the National Institutes of Health. It's the largest long-term study of brain development and child health in the United States. Krista, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks. It's my pleasure.
Well, I just said it was a new study. It actually launched in 2015, though. Can you talk a little bit about this big nationwide study and your role in the UW-Milwaukee's role in it?
Yes. So this is actually the largest study in the United States history to really understand kind of multiple factors that influence both brain, but also kind of cognitive, emotional, and physical health development from ages 9 and 10 all the way to about 19 and 20. So it's a 10-year longitudinal study with 21 different research sites throughout the United States. And one of them is here at UWM.
Can you talk about that era, 8 or 9 years old to 19 years old, and why that's so important for our brain development?
Yeah, so the adolescent, kind of early adolescent, late childhood area or time period, there is a lot of very dynamic changes going on. So we all know about kind of adolescent puberty and hormonal changes, but what we've discovered in the last 20 years or so is there's very dynamic changes in the brain development as well that are somewhat related to the hormones, but also kind of independent from that. And we see it's both this kind of golden opportunity for society and families to give that last bit of really strong support so youth can reach their full potential. And it also happens to be a sensitive period for the onset for a lot of mental health conditions, as well as health behaviors like substance use. So to really understand the onset of a lot of mental health conditions, we have to understand how they come on and what might make youth resilient to them during adolescence.
One thing I wonder about with a study this length and this size, we get questions on this show all the time about do things like screen time or social media use cause depression? And we might look and say, well, social media use is correlated with depression. I'm just making that up. But does that mean that depressed kids turn to social media, or is social media driving depression, or a little bit of both? Are you hoping to be able to tease out the causal factors here?
Yes, that's definitely one of our big questions, many questions about that causal timing, because a lot of the studies before would kind of be smaller studies of maybe, 50, maybe even 100 teenagers, and they're studied at one time point and given, some sort of interview or things like this. But ABCD study, we can take multiple measures over time and kind of see from time point A to B, did the onset of more social media, really cause depression? Or did what we see is the onset of depression causing, more social media usage? So we are trying to tease that apart. And one of the things we are looking at pretty closely is screen time. We do see this huge increase in screen time from ages like 9, 10 to even 12, 13. Doubling in use from maybe 4 hours a day or so at ages 9 and 10 to more like 8 or 9 hours a
Wow.
day in 12, 13-year-olds. And we do see some links with mood and mental health between screen time, and well-being, especially during the COVID-19 pandemic.
Talking to Krista Lisdahl, professor of psychology at UW-Milwaukee. She's part of this big nationwide study. It's happening here in Wisconsin as well, the Adolescent Brain Cognitive Development Research. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions for our guest. That's 800-642-1234. Screen time is one of the variables you're looking at. I want to focus on one that you have done a lot of work on in particular. When it comes to drugs, and you've focused on marijuana yourself, can you talk about what we know and what we're hoping to learn from this study?
Yeah, so what we know so far about what I would call more regular cannabis use or marijuana use is that during the teenage years, if people use, at least weekly to almost every day, they show somewhat reduced cognitive functioning in areas like sustaining their attention, maybe during, a boring lecture or a radio talk show, where you really have to pay attention over time, or their verbal memory is a little bit worse, as well as their speed of processing. We also see some subtle differences in how their brain processes information, where generally speaking, for the most part, they have to use more of certain brain areas like the prefrontal cortex or the parietal cortex to do the same cognitive task compared to peers that don't use. We do see that there might be some recovery of function if people stop using cannabis, if teenagers stop using, for 2 to 3 weeks, we see some improvements in cognition and mood. But what we don't know is if using for a long time during the adolescent years or the teenage years, does that cause longer term changes, that last into adulthood, even if they stop using because they use during a really critical period during development? So that's what we're hoping to study with the ABCD study.
Can you talk about the role of brain imaging in this study? What kind of things are you doing?
Yeah, so we do really extensive brain imaging. These kids, they're tremendous, junior scientists here that come in for almost 2 hours of brain imaging. So we get really high resolution pictures of their brain so we can look at their brain anatomy. We get some scans that are called diffusion tensor imaging, where we can actually look at some measures almost of the molecular structure of their white matter, which are the connections between different brain neurons in the brain. And then we also look at brain function, both at rest and during some different cognitive tasks where they're kind of engaging in puzzles and things like that.
We're talking to Krista Lisdahl, professor of psychology at UW-Milwaukee, looking at a long-term national study of youth brain development going on here in Wisconsin as well. Krista is a lead investigator on that study, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest about young and adolescent brain development? What do you wish you knew more about, maybe as a parent yourself, when it comes to what leads to different changes in our brains as we grow up? The study looks at things like drug and alcohol use, smoking, screen time, isolation, and more. Have you noticed that being a problem, maybe for your own kids in your own school? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk with UW-Milwaukee psychology professor Krista Lisdahl, looking at the nationwide adolescent brain cognitive development study. Our guest is the principal investigator for the Wisconsin part of that study, and you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions. What are you curious about when it comes to our brain's development in our youth and adolescent years? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Krista, we've mentioned this study started in 2015. We had the COVID-19 pandemic. How did your study adapt to deal with it? What kind of things are you hoping to learn about the impact of the pandemic?
Our study actually adapted rather quickly. We relaunched our interviews virtually within about a week of shutting down at the universities across the country. And what we focused on was trying to understand how we actually also, I'm sorry, launched a COVID-19 kind of sub-study and survey. So we wanted to understand like mental health during the pandemic, and found a lot of different resilience and risk factors related to improved or more problematic mental health of the youth during this very stressful period. So kind of peak pandemic, summer 2020, you can imagine, where a lot of families were disrupted. There was a lot of uncertainty. There were illnesses in the families, disruption in their parents' workplace, as well as schools shutting down. And we saw a lot of factors that were linked with teenager mental health, such as if families had more routines, like more regular scheduled meal times or outdoor activities, or really just a predictable schedule, the youth reported better mental health during that period. We also found like if they had a lot of moderate or more vigorous physical activity, they had better mental health outcomes during that time, such as less COVID-related worry and stress, as well as more social support and coping behaviors.
Now, I understand you're a parent yourself of a kid who's roughly the same age as those in the cohort. What's that been like for you, you know, experiencing reality as a parent while looking at the brain development of kids about that age?
Yeah, I mean, I think it makes me, you know, feel like a very living, engaged scientist, you know, that this isn't just theoretical. As a parent, you're always looking for some advice or evidence, you know, for things that you can do that are modifiable. You know, a lot of science in the past have talked about genetics or family risk factors and things like that maybe we can't change. So as a more health psychologist, I'm always looking for things that actually we can do. Like it was really helpful for me to see, for example, that parental monitoring of school activities during the pandemic and having kind of a routine and a structure, especially providing outdoor activities, was helpful at protecting mental health. And that's something where I put my energies personally, because I saw that data and it felt right as well. You know, it was right for me and my family. I also try and approach, you know, this work with some humility. You know, I have only one worldview, and we try and have a very diverse lab and diverse group of investigators and parents, you know, throughout the country, to really make sure that we don't have a one size fits all, you know, recommendations, and really understand multiple perspectives.
Talking to Krista Lizdahl, Director of Brain Imaging and Neuropsychology, the Brain Imaging and Neuropsychology Laboratory at UW-Milwaukee. Talking about a big national study she's involved in, the Adolescent Brain Cognitive Development Research. Krista, it's still ongoing, but there have been some spinoffs from it and some research that we can use, I think, in our daily lives, maybe in our parenting lives. What stand out to you as the biggest takeaways so far?
Yeah, so far I think that there's, I would maybe categorize it in three different spots. So the first one is more these health behaviors. Like we are learning that screen time does have an impact on mental health. And there's some recommendations to really consider limiting screen time to 2 to 3 hours a day. And if the youth are spending a lot of time on social media in particular, have regular conversations about cyberbullying, both, you know, your own youth potentially engaging in some of that or receiving it, because that in particular seems to be linked with a lot more depression and poorer mental health outcomes like anxiety, depression, poor sleep. And then sleep does play this really important role, and adolescents' brain are still developing, and they need more like 9 to 10 hours of sleep a night. So paying a lot of attention to that, getting increased physical activity that's linked with better mental health, as well as better cognitive performance. So that's kind of some of the more health behaviors. Then on the mental health side, it really seems like these very warm, engaged, you know, emotionally connected parent relationships, as well as relationships out in the community, maybe through your house of worship or through your school or neighborhood, are really protective for teenagers. We have to keep investing in that. And identifying youth that might be increased risk for health, mental health conditions, like experience with adverse child experiences, such as physical or sexual abuse, witnessing violence, parental substance use, or prolonged absence of a parent, that those youth seem to be at much increased risk for some mental health problems that have an earlier onset during the teenage years. So that kind of leads into some more of these more community or school-based interventions. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not just about the individual and the family. We also need to invest in our teenagers within our society, by making sure that all teenagers have access to high quality education and healthcare screening, maybe increasing mental health services in the schools, especially I see a lot of the districts talking about that as their top agenda coming out of the COVID-19 pandemic.
Do you have thoughts for parents, and you could speak here as a researcher and or a parent, on how to talk to kids about some of these things? It's easy to know, okay, yeah, sleeping more would be good for your kid, or advice on drugs or alcohol. Do you have thoughts based on the research on how parents can have those conversations about the stuff we're learning from your research?
Yeah, so for if I take on the substance use question, there is some evidence that having pretty open conversations, especially with youth that are in more like the 13, you know, to 17 year old age range about substance use, making it very clear what the household rules are, trying to restrict substance use for youth, and really explaining it in more of this health model, that there's a lot of evidence that substance use during the younger teenage years is related to, you know, poor mental health, depression, anxiety, lower grades, poor outcomes in, you know, being able to get into college or trade school. And that the brain is different during the teenage years versus the adult years. Another thing that has a lot of evidence is monitoring. So knowing where your kids are, asking who they're going to be with, asking if adults are going to be there, it just reduces some of these risk-taking behaviors. Teaching drink or drug refusal skills to the kids. So not the old kind of just say no, you know, advice was helpful, but maybe overly optimistic. You kind of have to really talk through if you're at a party and someone hands you a cup with beer in it, what are you going to do about it? What could you say?
And Krista, we'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest today, Krista Lisdahl, professor of psychology at UW-Milwaukee, director of the Brain Imaging and Neuropsychology Laboratory. She talked to us about the ongoing adolescent brain cognitive development research she's working on. Rising temperatures across the country could drive more people to the Great Lakes region. No one knows exactly what climate change will mean for Wisconsin's population, but as Danielle Kading reports, the changing climate is already playing a role in some people's decision to relocate.
Right now, there's no room for anything.
Colleen Rooney and her husband, Jim, are still unpacking. They moved to their new lakeside home in Vilas County last month. When they arrived, tall snowbanks blocked their view of the water.
I actually had to hire someone to come take a skid loader and get the snow away from the garage so we can unload the truck.
The Rooneys lived in Las Vegas for 20 years. Rarely did they deal with snow, but they did face intense heat.
You just didn't go anywhere when it was 115 degrees outside. Just to walk from your car to a grocery store across that blacktop was brutal.
While it wasn't the sole factor, the couple says extreme heat played a role in their decision to move to Wisconsin. Now some people are asking whether climate change could end up bringing more people to the state. A new group has formed to examine climate migration. Anna Haynes is a professor at the University of Wisconsin Stevens Point who's heading a committee to explore the issue.
We kept hearing about people are moving because of climate, sea level rise, big hurricanes, wildfires. So should Wisconsin be worried about this?
Haynes says they'll examine the positive and disruptive effects of climate migration and share any practices that can help communities. Climate migration experts like Jesse Keenan say people may seek out the Great Lakes region for its abundant access to fresh water. He's a professor of sustainable real estate at Tulane University in New Orleans.
The Great Lakes are where you begin in many ways, in the upper Midwest in particular. It's just much more mediating changing climate.
Even so, Keenan says no place is immune to climate change. Temperatures in Wisconsin could rise between 2 and 8 degrees by mid-century. Steve Vavaris is director of the State Climatology Office and a climate scientist at UW-Madison.
We talk about Wisconsin maybe relatively better than other parts of the country, but relatively is the key term because we have our own challenges.
As the Southwest struggles with access to water, Wisconsin has seen too much. The last decade was the state's wettest on record since the 1890s, and the state saw flooding and major storms. But because Wisconsin hasn't typically seen intense heat, some people argue that global warming will benefit Wisconsin. In a recent Senate Budget Committee hearing, Republican U.S. Senator Ron Johnson had this to say about a recent study of the projected effects of rising temperatures.
In my own state, your study shows that we'd have a reduction in mortality of somewhere between 54 and 56 people per, I guess it's 100,000. Why wouldn't we take comfort in that?
The study's authors say the effects of climate change will be very unequal. While Wisconsin may see fewer deaths due to cold, damages will be much worse across large sections of the country. Wisconsin saw a net gain of roughly 16,000 residents in the last year, and about half of them came from other states. But determining who may be a climate migrant is complex. That's according to Catherine Curtis, an environmental sociology professor at UW-Madison.
People tend to move for many reasons and sometimes intersecting reasons. And the climate or environmental conditions are certainly reasons for some people, but possibly only indirectly.
Colleen Rooney's family used to vacation and live in northern Wisconsin. Her emotional ties to the area played a role in the couple's decision to move. Curtis says federal census data shows most people moving to Vilas County come from nearby states, but they're also seeing residents relocate from states like California and Florida. She says that suggests climate migration could be happening, but stronger evidence is needed. While the Rooneys sought to beat the heat, they also had reservations about the cold. Jim says he initially moved away to escape long winters.
It seemed like things were mellowing out, but then we get up here and we got, how many feet of snow and cold.
Even so, Colleen says there's not a snowball's chance they would ever move back out west. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, a new Mayo Clinic study highlights the high cost of menopause for women in the workplace. And part of that study was done here in Wisconsin. check out the results, maybe share your own experiences. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Have you been out for a good hike lately? If so, we want to hear about it. Tomorrow on the show, we'll hear about a big hike coming to Wisconsin next weekend, the Mammoth March, covering 20 or 30 miles over the course of a day. Of course, we're not all going to hike like that. Me, I move at more of a sauntering pace. So we'll get some great suggestions for Wisconsin hikes, big and small. You can share yours, maybe plug a local favorite in your community. Email ideas@wpr.org to tell us about it or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Include pictures if you got them. And share your memories of hiking in your favorite places with friends, family, or solo. Again, email ideas@wpr.org or share your favorite hike on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Tell me where to take a hike. This is Central Time.